Took a tree kick down the canyon on the tee shot of hole 9. No one finer as a whiner than this grumbling guest of mine on the Fish Golf Broadcast.
All right, I have had the opportunity to be on this person's show before, and now it's his turn to come onto the Fish Golf Broadcast. We've got Charlie Eisenhood of UltiWorld and UltiWorld Disc Golf. Charlie, what you thinking about?
What's up, Andrew? The big thing right now in my world is I've kind of like finished up my season, and my wife is due with our first child in like 2 weeks. So you caught me at the right time, because in 2 weeks I will be unavailable for a while. So that's been the big thing around here.
And I imagine it's been a spectacularly busy fall for you, because you've had some commentary duties for Disc Golf Network. Additionally, for UltiWorld, of which you are the founder and senior editor. You'll have to walk me through all the titles you have. There was Ultimate Regionals for Club, and then Ultimate Nationals for Club, and then coming up is Beach Worlds for Club. It's just like bang, bang, bang. You're socked in every single week of this season.
It has been a very intense last like 6 months in particular. This whole year has been busy. You know, for those who are coming from a disc golf background, which I'm sure is the majority of the people listening to this podcast, you know, we kind of operate in some ways like the Disc Golf Network in Ultimate. So we are doing a lot of the live broadcasting of tournaments around the Ultimate calendar. And when I say we, you know, that's a team of people, and it's not as big as the Disc Golf Network crew, but it's, you know, we're still having to do lots of event logistics, getting cameras and personnel to various places, and doing broadcasts from all around the country in the middle of nowhere with nothing but cellular signal. So we face many of the same challenges as the Disc Golf Network. And so like, that's kind of what I would consider to be my primary job. You know, you ask me like, what is my title? That is what I do. I am kind of the, you know, I'm the CEO of UltiWorld and kind of making bigger picture decisions about the direction of the company, but I'm also kind of one of the primary producers and, let's say, the executive producer of a lot of that coverage in Ultimate. So I'm thinking about technology investments. You know, a lot of times I'm actually at tournaments, you know, at the Club Nationals, which is like the world's equivalent in Ultimate. I was the lead producer for all the ESPN games. So that's a whole incredible amount of preparation on its own. And then that's alongside my commentary work and everything else that I do in disc golf. So it's definitely been really busy. You know, I was in Europe for 3 weeks for European Open and PCS, which was awesome. Amazing to be on the ground, incredible environment, and a lot of fun. But it's also 3 weeks away from home. And, you know, I chose that, but I think I got it out of my system. Now that with a kid on the way, it's going to be a little tougher to pull all that off. And I'm going to have to get a little bit pickier with what I travel to. You know, I'm still going to be working hard and heavily involved. I just probably will not be at as many things next year as I was this year.
Yeah. And fortunately, you have created a media empire where remote work is possible for a lot of it. But I guess those on the ground experiences, like somebody's got to film it. And then for those live streams for Ultimate, you have to have somebody who is there, not just seeing the live feed to do the commentary, et cetera.
Yeah. And a lot depends on the scope of the event. And, you know, we've actually started to experiment with some of the remote broadcasting that DGN actually that does, you know. So when you watch a Disc Golf Network show, all of the hosts are not necessarily the commentators. Sometimes they're remote, sometimes they're on site, but all of the producers, replay, director, all of the, you know, control room staff, they're all remote. They're all dialing in from wherever they are in the world. And, you know, like Ian Lunger lives in Portland and Mahmood, I think, is back in Chicago right now. And so, you know, you have people all over the place and they're all logging into an Amazon server to produce these shows, which is extremely cool. I mean, they're really on the cutting edge in a lot of ways for the things that they're doing. We are experimenting with that. But for the biggest shows, we're always on site with everybody. It makes more sense in Ultimate because you have a field and you can put all your cameras right there and you don't have to have people walking around in the woods. But it is still a mostly remote, but still requires in-person stuff to do the job.
Yeah, definitely. So you're in such a good position to comment on the rise of media in both Ultimate and disc golf and have that kind of long-term perspective. Like many of this show's audience or even the players who are on the disc golf pro tour, they've only got a few years of context and it's from a very narrow perspective of like, what does that media mean for players? So like thinking about disc golf and Ultimate as media entities, I'm really curious about how post-produced disc golf took off, but post-produced Ultimate never really did. And then, you may not want to share numbers, but it doesn't seem like even live Ultimate has been that big a thing, except for like the very biggest games at the very biggest tournaments. And it seems like there should be a structural advantage to having, you know, a couple cameras that are positioned to see one field rather than having to be mobile throughout an entire round. And any thoughts on those ideas?
Yeah, it's a great question and something I think about a lot. You know, I probably think about that question more than literally anybody on the planet because, you know, the people who are doing stuff in disc golf, for the most part, either know nothing about Ultimate or, you know, passingly a no, but are like, well, I don't want to get involved in that because it's much smaller. And they're right. You know, I think I talk to people sometimes and I joke and it's like, I picked the wrong sport 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. You know, I think if I had hitched my wagon to disc golf in 2012 instead of Ultimate, we might have had a bigger company by now. Of course, it's impossible to know like how that all would have worked out. But let me try to tackle the question in multiple ways because there's kind of like the disparity between the two sports and how they've grown alongside each other and then sort of separated at times. And then there's the question about like viewership and fandom. So I think from a growth side, you know, I have this, the facts somewhere in a newsletter that I wrote a year and a half ago.
You can plug that if you want.
The newsletter is called Cashline. It's kind of dormant at the moment, but is going to be coming back in a bigger way next year, probably to become eventually either a weekly or biweekly newsletter that will be part of a subscription to UltiWorld Disc Golf as we kind of make some changes to the landscape there. And we could talk more about that later. But I asked Discraft, I said, you know, how much, you don't have to give me numbers, but like percentage-wise, how much of your business is Ultimate versus Disc Golf? And it used to be, not even that long ago, maybe 10 to 15 years ago, it was like 70% Ultimate, 30% Disc Golf, right? So they made a zillion UltraStars. Of course, Discraft essentially has a monopoly in Ultimate, at least in North America. I don't know. I don't know what the numbers would be, but it's probably like 95% of all Ultimate discs that are used in competitive play are the UltraStar made by Discraft, yeah, and has been for 30 years.
There's generations of Ultimate players who, if you toss them a Pulsar or you toss them a Daredevil or like even an Aria disc, they don't want to play with it because it doesn't feel right and it doesn't fly right.
That's right. Now, I disagree with that a lot of ways. I think that there are other really good discs. And, you know, for instance, the Aria has been used at tournaments in the last couple of years with no issues. I mean, essentially cloned the Ultra Star.
It's pretty darn close.
They like did multiple prototypes to get it as close as possible. But it's kind of weird coming from the disc golf world, that is, where people want different discs, right? They want different characteristics. They don't want everything to be the same. But in Ultimate, because it's a team sport where you have to have like ultra sameness on all of your throws at all times, you really want the same disc you've practiced all of your muscle memory with every time. Anyway, since the pandemic, that has completely inverted for discraft, and now it's like 80-20 disc golf. And that's both a sign, obviously, of disc golf's growth, but also of Ultimate having kind of receded a little bit in the last couple of years. It feels like we're starting to get back post-COVID finally, like now, in the last 6 months, but it's been a slow process. So we've seen this incredible growth in disc golf and a period of stagnancy, and then because of COVID, decline in Ultimate that has kind of fueled this changeover in the sports and kind of their relative paths. So that's kind of the baseline. So when you ask about, why is post-produced disc golf, why did that take off on YouTube and what made it so popular? I think it's a number of things. I think for one, because it's an individual sport and there's one round of kind of like interesting competitive disc golf per day at a tournament, right? So if I want to go and I want to cover, let's say, the Memorial to go to a throwback tournament at this point, you can go out there with a couple cameras and you can cover the top players playing for the win in one round and then it's done. And then you go back and you edit it and you put it up. Now, if you want to do this in Ultimate, there's really only one game, right? You would do the finals, but you're missing so much context from the rest of the tournament that if you tried to cover all of those games leading up, quarter, semis, finals, and maybe some of the pool play, it would be impossible to get it all edited and produced and put up on YouTube. Now, I do wonder if there was a world in which the finals of big tournaments from the past were made available for free, next day, cut down to size with player commentary. Would it have been popular?
Probably. I kind of think so.
But I don't think it would have been Jomez.
Probably not. Because it was never really tried. And like, you can look at, say, go look at the 2016 Ironside win in the finals. Like, that's a fucking awesome game. It was like 10 years of catharsis for Boston to go win that game. But you can look at the streamed copy that ESPN put out live where they misfilmed the backfield and they would have really awkward replay cuts. And, it's Evan Leppler, who does a pretty decent job and has grown into the role well. Kind of talking like this about it. It just doesn't have like replay value in the way that a condensed disc golf round of the final round of Worlds would.
It's true. And I think part of it is what you say, which is that, for this formative time in disc sports media, the biggest games have always been produced by production teams who don't know anything about Ultimate and don't care about Ultimate. And they've all been behind the ESPN gateway, basically, which has pros and cons. It's nice to have the shiny ESPN name next to your sport. It probably opens some doors with certain organizations when you're trying to partner with them to say, hey, this is on ESPN. But it meant that you had camera operators who didn't know anything about the sport, producers who didn't know anything about the sport, for a long time, commentators who didn't even necessarily know anything about the sport. And the broadcasts were lackluster as a result. And those games, you couldn't just go out and pull a Jomez and be like, hey, I'm going to go out there with my camera in 2015 and film this thing that no one else cares about, and I'm going to put it up on YouTube. So that's part of it. But I also think there's like the part of it that Jomez, like the production quality that they put into it and the graphics and the care that they put into it. There's also the commentary side of it where they like managed to just like hit this home run with Jeremy Colling and Nate Sexton early on that like these guys just work so well. And, you know, they didn't stick with Macbeth, for instance, who's a great player, a great guy, but he's not a great commentator. Like, sorry to say it. I would say it to his face. Like, he doesn't have the gift the way that Nate Sexton does. So they get these great commentators. They have, you know, perfectly suitable cameras for the work that they're doing up close. You don't need to have amazing cameras when you're super close like that. And, you know, they do some really innovative stuff with their graphics work at a time when disc golf was still like in this growth phase. And then, boom, the pandemic hits, the sport 2.5-3x's in size, something like that, in the span of about 2 years. And you have this platform for this all to just explode. And so I think there's that whole side of it. The missing piece as to why disc golf has boomed while Ultimate has not. And, you know, you asked about the numbers. I'll give you the numbers. 10 times more people watch a big disc golf broadcast than an Ultimate one.
Equivalent tournament live?
Yeah. Hmm. Like, if you were to talk about Worlds versus Club Nationals, I mean, I don't have all of the numbers because I don't see the ESPN numbers, for instance. But I suspect that being on ESPN is probably more of a negative than a positive in terms of number of eyeballs. But, like, even when the streams are free, the biggest Ultimate games get maybe 8,000-9,000 live concurrent viewers. That would be a really good number. And a free big disc golf broadcast of a world's final round as a tight battle or something like that is going to have 30,000 to 40,000, if not more, live concurrent viewers. So what is the difference there? Is it simply that there are more disc golfers? At this point, probably that's true. But I think what it more is that there's a draw to the pro game that is easier to access. And there's more of the demographics of disc golf yield a more typical sports fan, right? It's you know, disc golfers come from all backgrounds, but I think in general, it tends to be more centrist, more rural, more sports fan, you know, of NFL and NBA and whoever teams than Ultimate, which is coming out of elite colleges, is highly educated, highly wealthy, very left wing, and less likely to care about, you know, sports. Also, there's way more women who play competitive Ultimate than there are women who play competitive disc golf. And I think that also, the demographics of, you know, male fandom of sports, for all the reasons we could go into a whole separate podcast about, like, there's more draw towards wanting to watch than just wanting to play. There are thousands of Ultimate players who play every week in their rec league and know nothing about what's going on with the top teams. And they've never watched a stream. And they probably will never watch a stream. And I think that is one of the big differences. That's true of disc golfers too, but I think the percentage of players who are Ultimate fans and like watch the streams is a way smaller percentage than in disc golf.
So I wonder if some of that is a failing of Ultimate teams in marketing and branding, where like many of the elite disc golfers are seen as very marketable because of their social media following, but it's kind of like Callahan videos and highlight tapes. We're out of that phase in Ultimate for the most part. Like, teams aren't putting those out to hype themselves up, and you know, Seattle Sockeye and Riot and BFG and Mixtape or whatever are not branding themselves as like Seattle's team and you should come watch us because like we're your hometown favorite or something at Nationals. Do you think that that's just Ultimate teams not caring enough, or is it because you got 25 players on a team versus one disc golfer who's able to, you know, leverage their own content and marketability for themselves?
I certainly think it's easier to promote individual athletes than it is to promote a team. And, you know, you look at this, look at the big sports, you know, think about the NFL, world's most popular. Well, I shouldn't say worlds. Soccer's number one, but in the US, NFL is king. Millions and millions of people watch the NFL. And even the NFL struggles to make individual stars out of anybody besides their top five quarterbacks in the league. You know, nobody's talking about the linebackers and
I'm a left guard whoever. Kind of guy.
There you go. I mean, if you're a hardcore fan, you probably know the names of at least players on your team. But I think it's a lot easier to grab onto a star, an individual star. You know, it's what makes golf and tennis big, rich, popular sports because it's easy to follow them. So I think that's a big part of it. You know, I studied economics in college, Fish, and to me, one of the big differences between the sports is that in disc golf, there's a money incentive at tournaments. And now for top players, there's a very clear money incentive for promotion and marketing via social media and other avenues.
Going back to the earlier discussion about Discraft's breakdown of ultimate versus disc golf product, every disc golfer, you know, even going out to the casual players at the course, they've got 20 discs in their bag. An ultimate team of 25 people has 20 discs in their disc bag. Like there's right. So much more product that can be pushed in disc golf. Whereas with ultimate, it's, you know, it's player funded and your equipment is very minimal.
Exactly. And so there's this business ecosystem in disc golf that exists that probably will never come to ultimate in the same way. The companies that succeed in ultimate are apparel companies because they're selling jerseys and shorts to every team. And so there's lots of them, but there's really only one disc manufacturer of note. And you're never going to have that same level of ability to sell products and create a business in ultimate because people just don't need that much stuff. They need cleats and they need one disc for a whole team. Yeah, sure, for practice, maybe you need 20 for your team of 25. But disc golf, I mean, every single player needs a bag and 20 discs, and then they want to get the cool one and get the signature on it. And there's so many accessories beyond that. It just creates this really rich ecosystem. And so that money is flowing into players' pockets. And so now they have more of an incentive to post on social media. And that makes it easier to become a fan because your favorite player is on DGN and on Jomez, and you can follow them on Instagram. And so like there's this virtuous circle of all of this growth funneling towards continued like creation of content. And you know, look at the Pro Tour's done. I mean, they've professionalized things so much in the last 3 years. It's hard to believe when you look back on what it looked like before 2020. It was a completely different ball game, and that's just in 3 years. And some of that's fake it till you make it, but there's a lot of real there too. And you know, you've got DGN with 50,000+ subscribers, and that's a real business.
I'm Felix with Ace Run Productions, and I listen to the Fish Golf Broadcast while I'm traveling to yet another town that you've never heard of.
I'm Scott Withers, and I listen to the Fish Golf Broadcast while I try to convince myself to go practice.
If you like where this show is headed, stick around for part two. We'll never barrage you with 11 minutes of droning external ads to start the show. So please support the Fish Golf Broadcast by visiting discgolfbra.com for hats and other apparel. Fish stamp discs are available at fishdiscgolf.com and daddydiscgolf.com, and you can save 10% on upperparkdiscgolf.com with the code Andrew10 on backpacks and other items. And now, more lies and outrageous claims from our guest, met with calm reason by Fish.
I think it's pretty easy to point at ultimate
and disc golf and say that there's more stuff in one and less stuff in the other. But like a basketball team only needs a couple balls, and then the players have their shoes and their jerseys, and that's it. Why, in theory, with the constant action of ultimate and the like, the very creative throws and highlight plays, in theory, like the gameplay of ultimate should be more marketable than the gameplay of disc golf.
100%. I think, you know, talk about basketball. What makes basketball successful? Well, for one, millions of people play.
And it's 60 years ahead of disc golf's in like starting and growing.
Yes. And you have, you know, the National Basketball Association, which does have the benefit of both sort of like the team fandom side of the sport, where like I rep my city, but also the individual, because one to two players per team are the stars, and it's really easy to market them, and they're on the court a lot, and they're not wearing a helmet, and like they do more than any of the other sports leagues to really create stars out of their players. It's, I think, you know, basketball for a long time has had the most sort of pop culturally relevant athletes outside of maybe some tennis players. You know, you can pick names out of a hat, I guess, but you know, Jordan, LeBron, Steph, like these guys are not only household names, but they are like superstars outside of their sport venue. So, you know, ultimate, the problem is it just needs way more participation, but the kind of like grassrootsiness of it all and the anti-profit sort of like ethos of the sport, where people get mad when they have to pay, you know, $40 per person to go to a tournament on a weekend, creates a lot of difficulties for anybody to make a sustainable living out of being involved. And so that means that, you know, when you don't, you know, okay, we want to have more kids playing, right? We want to be lacrosse, right? Lacrosse is this like super successful youth first sport that is now like has multiple pro leagues, and like they haven't made it necessarily, but it's way further along than a lot of other niche sports. And what happened there is that like they just did an incredible job of getting people involved to create youth opportunities back like 20, 30 years ago, and they're reaping the benefits today. And lacrosse is still the number one fan side of lacrosse is college. The college championships are on, you know, broadcast live on ESPN, and it's like a big deal. So I think, you know, the gameplay part of it is cool for ultimate, but you need people to play in order to create fans out of those players. And I don't think that ultimate's path to success is, you know, NFL, where people are just tuning in because they're like, oh, I love to watch ultimate frisbee, even though I've never played it. And what, probably 75% of the NFL's fans never played football?
Yeah, absolutely. You don't have to be a player to be a fan, but there has to be some path in, which I guess is why, you know, identifying with a college's alumni base to promote their run at college championships, or, you know, a club team's locale of like, you know, Chicago, let's put on for our city this week. I don't know that I would have done it any better if I was running a team starting in, you know, 2012, when like social media could go viral. But like retrospectively, it just seems so weird that, that there isn't an ultimate team other than like Buzz Bullets, which had some weird, funding structure. Like nobody's figured out in the club game, which is still the most elite set of players, how to make their season free even.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think if teams took it more seriously about trying to monetize, that they probably could get, maybe not to free, because it's, you know, 25 people plus multiple flights per season, and it all adds up pretty fast, but take a big chunk out of what it costs to participate if they were getting local sponsors and they were doing more work to promote their their team online. I mean, it hardly a team does it. You know, 10 years ago, Sakai did a pretty good job. But these days, I don't even know if they still have a website. Like, it's just not something that's a part of the culture. And even the top players, many of them are not on Instagram or on social media in a public way. And that couldn't be more opposite to disc golf, where you're basically required to do social media or you won't get a sponsor.
And I think a divergence in our conversation that we could go down is that good or bad for, like, for the players? Is that good or bad for the teams? Is that good or bad for the health of the sport as a whole entity? Like, is it necessarily good that a few disc golfers are getting, like, really, really financially well made, but it's kind of this, like, false American dream of, if you work really hard and don't go to college, you know, you too could win 5 world championships or something?
It's a fair question to ask. I tend to take a very pro-growth mindset. So I think, and, you know, maybe you could answer this question, that even though, sure, the vast majority of people, of disc golfers on tour, are not making Macbeth money, right? Like, there are 3 or 4 or 5 guys at the top of MPO who are being very, you know, well remunerated to play disc golf. But then there's a lot of people who are in the middle and lower classes of touring life, where it's still grind, hoping to cash, and all of that. But things have gotten better for those people over the last 5 to 10 years in a significant way, where people are now, even like middle tier pros, are making a real salary. Now, it may not be enough to pay for your health insurance and have a 401k and everything else that you would want to do and have like a house and an RV or whatnot, but people are actually able to like live a normal life and have money in the bank. Now, I don't know how much that's true, and it probably varies from company to company and certainly player to player, but I think that the rising tide here is bringing all the boats up, even as some people at the top are making 6 or 7 figures a year.
Yeah, definitely. Like, it is very possible to make it on tour, even if you're not winning, as long as you cash sometimes and are able to stitch together a few other sources of income. Now, let me throw this back at you, that growth has dramatically improved like touring pros, but a lot of the tournament directors or people who are maintaining courses or private course owners or those who are running a relatively small independent disc-based journalism company and trying to hire employees to fill various needs there, have you been able to see a commensurate growth since, let's say, 2020?
The short answer in the disc golf world is no.
Why? Like, shouldn't UltiWorld, with articles and coverage, be providing a service that like the disc golf community collectively should be rallying around?
Yes, in theory. I think, you know, you look at the history of disc golf media outside of the YouTube folks, right? So let's exclude video. Talking about people writing articles, doing podcasts, whatnot. There's just not been money there. They've all failed. UltiWorld Disc Golf exists right now with me as the editor, and like we are on the fence about whether we need to try to hire a full-time editor to like really do more. But where are we going to make money? Right, I'll tell you how people make money in disc golf. It all comes back to the same thing. They sell discs. That's how everybody makes money in disc golf. That's how players make money. They may not sell them personally out of their trunk anymore, but it's the ones with their name on it that are selling that's paying their check that's going into their account. And of course, that's how the manufacturers make money. And pretty much any of the websites that do, you know, media, I mean, look at Foundation. I don't know what percentage of their money comes from like selling frisbees, but it's probably most.
Yeah. And if they have advertisers, their advertisers are probably there because like Foundation sells discs, not necessarily because of their like podcast output or something.
Right. Right. And you know, not that you can't make a small business out of this. You can. We're doing it. We have a small disc golf business. But I can't say that, you know, it's like we've made it on the disc golf side. No. You know what? If frankly, if I shut down Old Sea World Disc Golf tomorrow, stop doing the upshot and just bounced out of disc golf completely, it would be a relatively small hit to our overall bottom line. Like, we are an ultimate business that is doing disc golf and trying to figure out a business model that will work. And look, it's not easy for anybody. Look at Jomez. They didn't make it. Like, yes, they got acquired, so I guess that makes them having made it, but like they had to sell in a pinched off spot where they didn't want to have to sell, but they had no choice because costs started to overrun revenues coming out of COVID. And like, it's not easy to make it in the media business. And I, you know, the gatekeeper guys and these folks who are out on the road that are doing media on YouTube, and they're all probably still grinding crazy just to make ends meet. And they're like getting tens of thousands of views on YouTube. YouTube views do not like feed you, you know, like unless you're doing millions, it's hard to make a business out of that. So I don't know. I think in some ways we had opportunities that we didn't capitalize on early, but it's also just hard because even though there's like demand for articles and stuff, I mean, I think there's a reason you haven't seen another website pop up to do like media coverage of disc golf, because there's not really a business model that makes sense. Advertising alone simply will not do the job. And, you know, for better or worse, it's not like the manufacturers are knocking down their door to being like, hey, I want to advertise on your website. It's a little contentious sometimes, frankly, with the manufacturers. And that's because we are like writing about what things are happening. And sometimes that's got negative press. And the disc golf industry really doesn't like that. They like to have things be very much PR all the time. They want to control their own media, release their own hype videos, all that stuff. And so that's just a really interesting side note here. It's like there's enough there that we want to keep working on it, but it's not obvious what the business model should be for an independent news organization besides putting everything behind a paywall and like going Wall Street Journal mode. But I don't know that that's the right thing for the sport. And I certainly don't know if there's enough demand for that to make sense either.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, even if you give like free introductory content, if that doesn't convert into people buying your stuff or subscribing, like it kind of just dies on the vine right there. So I got a couple different questions about you being you know, like an independent media organization in disc golf. So first, as you note, various entities in disc golf, whether that be manufacturers or the Disc Golf Pro Tour or the PDGA or others, they don't want to be criticized because it looks bad for them. But like, you are currently also a live commentator for DGN. How do you balance being able to take a fair and capital C critical perspective while still having to kind of be the mouthpiece, the visible arm of their operation sometimes?
Yeah, it's a great question. When I step into the booth, my job is to present the sport and be an ambassador of Disc Golf Network and, you know, be a commentator. But even in those situations, there's times when I think it's reasonable to critique a rule that's in place or comment on something on the course being out of place or something like that. But certainly it's a different mindset than when I go on to the Upshot podcast and want to weigh in on a topic. Frankly, while I have to say, of course I'm more aware of the fact that like I have this other association, but I'd still just say what I think. You know, like I'm not really like my whole for 10, you know, how long I've been doing this now? 11 years. I try to be honest and fair. And if I get something wrong, I'll come on and I say, I got this wrong. And if I think somebody, you know, an organization in disc golf or ultimate has made a stupid mistake, I'm going to call it a stupid mistake. And it just is what it is. Like, if you just are a mouthpiece, what's the point? I try to do a great job as a play-by-play commentator and present the sport in a way that is entertaining to people at home. And I hope that the Disc Golf Network folks think that that's true and they want to have me back. But if they don't, or if somebody comes down on high and says, I don't like what Charlie said and don't hire him again, he's out. Okay. Like I will just not do it anymore. I mean, that's really the attitude that I have to take towards it, because I'm not going to not give my opinion because I'm afraid that I'm not going to like be a commentator on DGN. It's not enough. It's not like it's my, like, if I lose that, I'm ruined. And so I'm thankful to have that level of independence that like, I don't have to censor myself. But it, you know, it's still, there's always a tension there, of course. But you know, it's not like I go out of my way to be critical, but sometimes I think the Disc Golf Pro Tour does something silly and I will say that, but so much of the time they're doing really smart things and they've made a lot of good decisions over the last, you know, 3-4 years that have helped them go from an organization that was on the brink of failure to being, this like a COVID success story. So there's a lot of good things to talk about. And, we spend the most of our time talking about the sport and what's fun and not just complaining. So
yeah, sure. In a similar vein, I guess it's pretty easy for you to just comment on tournament results or do a preview that doesn't require quotes from players or organizers or anybody like that. But I know Drew Gibson has been another who's not afraid to speak his mind, has been critical of UltiWorld. Like, he won't talk to you. Are there other players or people in disc golf who, you know, just won't give you the time of day, or that you've had to repair a relationship after criticizing them?
There are some, I don't really know how much I want to name names, but there are some players who like basically do not engage.
Do they give reasons for it, or is it just,
sometimes, like, I've talked to Drew. I had a conversation with Drew, I don't know, probably early this year sometime, to be like, hey, like, what's the deal? Drew is very upset about a situation from last year when, like, no, 2 years ago, right? Utah Worlds, was that 2 years ago?
21, yeah.
21. So at the time, there was like some discussion. I heard a rumor from a player that like players were considering boycotting the PDGA over some of the failures at 2021 Worlds. And I asked Drew about it because I had heard that he was one of the people who was sort of involved in pushing this in a private player's Facebook. And he wanted to know who told me. And I said, well, I don't really feel like it's important and I don't necessarily want to give you the name because like I wanted to protect this person who told me this. Ultimately, it went to the top. The DGPT people found, or the PGA people found out who it was, and they got in big trouble or whatever. But because I wouldn't tell him, Drew was really upset about that and now thinks that like I was being dishonest or like trying to start something, even though there was nothing ever published about this situation. And I spoke to Drew about it because I wanted to get his context and perspective. And I talked to him for like 25 minutes at Worlds. I don't really mind publicly sharing this now. I have no ill will towards Drew, but certainly he has, and he has also said he doesn't have ill will towards UltiWorld Disc Golf. He has ill will towards me personally.
Somehow that's worse.
So he will talk to other reporters at UltiWorld Disc Golf, but he won't talk to me, which, you know what? Fair enough. That's fine. I've attempted to like repair the relationship. I would still be happy to repair the relationship, but it is what it is. You know, I think there's there's definitely pros and cons to the kind of the independent approach that I tend to take towards covering the sport. There's players I have a great relationship with. There's players I have a neutral relationship with. And there's definitely players who I have a bad relationship with. And I think that's just, I accept that as part of the territory. I don't want to have a bad relationship with anybody. But, you know, sometimes when you get on the podcast and you talk about players who are not playing well, and like, people can be sensitive about that stuff. And I totally understand that. And so, you know, we try to ask people to come on the podcast anytime, and lots of players come on, and I think we enjoy interviewing and promoting these players to the wider world of disc golf. But you know, it's part of the, it comes with the territory, I think, that you're not always going to win friends when you're commenting about people on a podcast.
For sure. And far more when you're having to do like real journalism, in the sense that like you're criticizing the PDGA as an entity for a choice or a strategic decision that they've made. Like, that's a lot different than just saying like Fish just didn't perform down the stretch. Like he yeah. gave that tournament away. Like, yeah, I already know that. You're not telling me anything I don't know. But like, it's so you can see in like membership participation in PDGA elections or public comment on various things, like engagement is so low for things that are actually impacting the sport, but like dumb tweets or videos will go viral in seconds. It's this really
2023.
Yeah. Really, really weird dichotomy. Fun society we've got here. All right, Charlie, I'm sure we could go on for far, far longer, but I've taken up enough of your time. You got to get yourself ready for Beach Worlds, as well as decorating a room for a small child, I'm sure. If you enjoyed this show and want to find more, you can go through our back catalog. We're kind of winding down the 2023 season. You can also find me on Instagram and whatever the fuck Twitter is at fish58320. And if you hated the show, you found our guest very uninformed, and we need to holler at somebody about it, where can folks find you, Charlie?
Well, they can email me directly and tell me why I'm wrong at charlie@ultiworld.com. I'm not a big social media guy personally, so email is the best way to get in touch with me. But if you have podcast takes, upshot@ultiworld.com is also a good one. And if you add us relentlessly enough on Twitter, I will probably see it there at some point.
All right. And can you close us out by talking about some long retired ultimate player who popped into your consciousness at some point in the recent past?
Long retired ultimate player popped in my consciousness. This feels like a cop out because I feel like I saw him recently, but Dylan Tennell is somebody who comes to mind from the most recent times. Legendary player from Atlanta in the like late 2000s, won a championship with Chain Lightning in 2009, came back like 7 years later and won an AUDL MVP out of nowhere, and is now coaching and doing other stuff.
That was so bizarre because like his mobility was nothing like it used to be, but he still had just ridiculous flick cannon.
Just an absolute like rocket launcher attached to his shoulder. So there you go. It's a fun time to cover disc sports. I will say that. I feel like we talked about a bunch of like sort of like the little weird undercurrents that are going on, but I'm very energized by the last 12 months of disc sports. I think disc golf had a really good season. Like lots of positive steps happening. And Ultimate just had its best club season in like maybe ever, at least a decade. Just an awesome season, awesome nationals. So excited, hoping to see the sport continue to grow and become a favorite for fans new and old.
That's all for this episode of the Fish Golf Broadcast. but be sure to check out previous episodes and subscribe wherever fine podcasts are sold. Check out Fish Golf Broadcast hats and other apparel at discgolfbra.com and badger your friends until they listen too. Join us next time as I goad yet another guest into starting a fight with another touring player, campsite host, or toll booth attendant on the Fish Golf Broadcast.